Hey everybody, this is Aubrey Chavez from Faith Matters. For today's episode, we were honored as always to bring back one of our favorite people and conversation partners, and likely one of yours, Terrell Givens. We spoke with Terrell about a book that he released in 2021, a biography called Stretching the Heavens, The Life of Eugene England and the Crisis of Modern Mormonism. Terrell's work on this biography led to a fascinating portrait of a man that many of us look up to and someone we truly wish we could have met. England died in 2001 at the age of 68. His legacy has proved to be both broad and enduring, and in addition to a long and storied career in academia, he was the founder of Dialogue, a journal of Mormon thought, and of the Association for Mormon Letters. His writing continues to move and inspire Latter-day Saints today, including through essays that have become classics, like Why the Church is as True as the Gospel. In our interview with Terrell, we talk not just about the arc of Eugene England's life, but about the principles that arose from the insights he shared and some of the struggles that he faced. In particular, we talk through some of the issues that came up for him as a man striving to be both true to his own conscience and to the authority of an institution he fully believed in and loved when the two didn't fully align. In many ways, this seems to be the conflict at the heart of discipleship and even of Christianity's creation story. Regardless, we felt like exploring it through the lens of Eugene England's life was both relevant and poignant. This book, Stretching the Heavens, was published by UNC Press and is available on Amazon and Audible. We really hope that you enjoyed this conversation. As always with Terrell, we were moved and inspired by what he shared with us, and we think that you will be too. And with that, we'll jump right in. All right. Well, welcome back, Terrell. We genuinely look forward to all of our conversations with you. So thanks for coming back.
So do I. Thank you.
Thanks. And this conversation has been a long time coming. We've been reading this book for a while and just savoring it. And I was thinking Eugene England comes up actually quite a bit on the podcast because I think his influence is still very relevant to us. But I felt that even more deeply. I just finished this book and I feel so much gratitude for the depth of his influence in our life right now and in our engagement with the church. And so I was glad for that understanding to be expanded a little bit because I think I just knew the tip of the iceberg. And it was really a beautiful experience to understand his actual sacrifice and the depth of his own pain, really, to be morally courageous and honest and do a lot of things that I think really influence how the church is today, or at least how I am in the church today.
No, I think that's true. I think in some ways his life and writings are more relevant today than they were when I wrote the book.
Yeah, I caught myself at the end thinking, you know, I think you would have fit better in a 2023 church. And then I was like, oh, like maybe the 2023 church fits better because of all of the work and the pushing this boulder that he did in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. And I really just felt this profound sense of gratitude for whatever ripple has created the space that we really inhabit so much more comfortably than he did now, you know. Anyway, do you want to talk about the title of the book? Can you tell us about Stretching the Heavens and then the life of Eugene England and the crisis of modern Mormonism?
Yeah, the title comes from just a passage I came across in Erasmus where he said, I don't know why I bother to defend myself with a single example, seeing that it's generally the generally accepted privilege of theologians to stretch the heavens like tanners with a hide. Mm. And that just seemed to me an apt description of Gene England's role, stretching the heavens in the sense that he, in some ways, kind of reenacted Joseph Smith's dictum about by proving contrarieties, truth is made manifest. And so he followed his inclinations and his search for truth and understanding all the way into the margins of orthodoxy. And yet without ever compromising his faith. And I think that was a fundamental tension in his life.
Mm. How about the crisis of modern Mormonism? What are you referring to there?
Yeah, well, you know, every publisher wants the word crisis in the title. And I pushed back against that, but lost the battle.
Okay.
But it would actually be more accurate to say the life of Gene England and the crisis of Mormon modernism.
Mm.
And I don't mean to just be clever there. Modernism, right, one of its many meanings, is a genuine crisis that both Catholicism and Protestantism experienced in the early 20th centuries with the development of what historians refer to as a historical consciousness. So as more and more work is done excavating the history of a compilation of the Bible, the history of the early church, the human element in both, then both traditions, Catholic and Protestant, in their own ways, had to address the question, well, where do we draw the line once we let the, well, mix my metaphors, once the nose of the camel comes into the tent and we acknowledge a human element in religious institutions, then where do we put on the brakes so that we don't abandon faith in the divine provenance behind both scriptural construction and the history of the church? And so in Protestantism, it leads to a kind of fissure between what today we call fundamentalism and more liberal varieties. And in Catholicism, the church didn't fracture, but they lost a good number of leading intellectuals who either resigned or were excommunicated from the church as a result of trying to accommodate this human element. And so the question that I asked as I was trying to situate Jean England's life within a cultural history of the Latter-day Saints was, where was Mormonism? And why didn't we experience the same kind of crisis? And I think there are a few reasons why we did, but about 75 years later. So there's this kind of delayed confrontation with the nature, right, of or the role of history and culture in forming or shaping the unfolding of the church. And I think a couple of reasons for that. One is because Latter-day Saints have always been hostile to theology. And so the developments in biblical criticism never really infiltrated into the church. There's also much greater confidence in, reliance upon prophetic inspiration, prophetic leadership. So there's been the sense that, you know, we don't really need the assets of the academic community to understand our faith and its past. And then what happens by the time you get to the 1960s and 70s is, right, you have this kind of burgeoning interest in doing a professional version of history. So you get the professionalization of Latter-day Saint history. You get the first professional historian, Leonard Arrington, appointed to the history department. You get the formation of journals like BYU Studies and then eventually Dialogue. And then you get the internet. And suddenly, wait, we have access ourselves to the church's archives and history and diaries and journals. And so it's like at that moment, then the church has to work through this agonizing confrontation of the own stories, the way we've been telling our own history, and what newly uncovered or newly accessed primary sources have to say that might be in a different key. Yeah.
Okay, I have a question about this. So contemporary critics of the church might say that in a sort of simplified manner, the church for many decades was essentially, quote, hiding its history, right? And it was, potentially this increased interest in history, more professional historians. But like you said, overall, the internet was sort of like this wave of truth, and the church lost control of the narrative. That's sort of what a critic might say. I don't know if you buy that narrative. I felt like reading this, it didn't really seem that way to me, actually. I felt like there was no...
There weren't a bunch of old men in smoke-filled rooms.
This is what I'm getting at.
Saying, what are we going to let out this week?
Yeah. It's like he had so many clashes with the brethren, and I definitely want to get into that. But they were not... It didn't seem like they were coming from a place of deception at all, but a place of maybe a rigid faith and even a defensiveness.
I think there's no question there was a defensiveness to the faith. I mean, if you just look at the architecture of Utah temples, the first four temples, what do they look like, right? They look like medieval castles.
Yeah.
And I think that reflects the sense. And if you look at the Journal of Discourses, the talks given from the tabernacle in those first decades, there's definitely this sense that, okay, we've been kicked out of the United States. They can all go to perdition. We are going to barricade ourselves in and cut ourselves off from worldly influences and so forth. So I think there is part of that. I think a lot of factors are contributing to the tension between these ways of narrating the Latter-day Saint past. I don't put conspiracy anywhere in the list. Yeah. I think, for one thing, as I mentioned, there was a lack of professional historians in the church historian's office. They were always general authorities. And you know, Joseph Fielding Smith dominated that office for half a century. I think there was a genuine lack of familiarity. I mean, the leaders are not trained as historians. So it's not like the Quorum of the Twelve had access to these primary sources that they were right. keeping from the rest of the church.
Yeah.
A lot of those things really were virtually unknown until historians began to excavate. For example, the first work was being done by Mike Quinn on post-manifesto polygamy, right? Nobody knew. Nobody was aware of the fact that the church was performing polygamous right marriages in the endowment house. I remember his recounting of a meeting he had with Gordon B. Hinckley, where Gordon B. Hinckley was stunned. He didn't know this.
Yeah.
So yeah, these were genuine new discoveries.
I wonder, and just side note, we can cut this if we need to. But so he had several clashes with Bruce R. McConkie.
Yeah.
And I wonder if in this vein, there was almost like a, there's almost, it seems so clear, you know, from very easy to access sources these days, that there is a strong human element. If you read about Joseph Smith, if you read about Brigham Young, if you read about what happened post-manifesto, all those things, it's almost undeniable. But when you read the words of some of the brethren that Eugene England is sort of, coming into these clashes with, it almost appears as though they have begun to believe that they are infallible, that there's this sort of like, and maybe it was a lack of access to information, because I don't feel like Elder McConkie could have read about Brigham Young or Joseph Smith in really historically accurate ways and then come away with the impression that he can't make a mistake, which is the impression that I got from some of his own words. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I wouldn't use the word infallible to describe his self-perception. That may be the case, but I think for him, it was a matter of keys and it was a matter of authority.
Yeah.
Mm. And in that famous letter he wrote to Gene England, right? He said, it is my province to declare doctrine.
This is the quote I'm thinking of.
And so I don't think he's saying it's my province to declare it infallibly, but I think he's saying I have the keys to pronounce it and you don't.
Yeah.
And so I think this has been a perennial tension in the church. It persists to the present day. The brethren guard very jealously their prerogative to be the arbiters of doctrine. And at any moment when they think somebody is threatening that role, then there's conflict and problems. And I think I'm hoping that the situation changes with time, because part of the explanation, I think, is an unwillingness to recognize that theology is not the same enterprise as doctrine.
Yeah.
And that one can engage in the enterprise of trying to understand and explain and expound and talk about the origins and the implications and the consequences and the context out of which doctrines emerge. And that's a theological enterprise. Mm-hmm. And it's one that doesn't claim any authority for itself. But a lot of times it can look to the leadership like those explorations are claiming an authority.
Yeah.
Right. Explicitly or implicitly. And that was brought to the fore very directly with Gene England, right? When he thought he was safe when he wrote about, for example, polygamy in heaven, which he thought would not exist. And he called it at the beginning of his essay, an essay in speculative theology. Mm-hmm. And he thought that was kind of the warning.
Yeah.
Proviso, don't take this. But he was told by Boyd K. Packer, sorry, you're not to do speculative theology.
Yeah.
And so I think that at that moment, and maybe to some extent at the present, right, there's an unwillingness to create a space for what Gene England saw as speculative theology.
I'm curious if you have a good working definition of doctrine, potentially. When I hear that quote, my job is to declare doctrine, but it may not be that he meant that infallibly. If he did not mean it infallibly, then potentially that means that declared doctrine could change. But to this day, you hear very commonly as a defense of current church practices, doctrine doesn't change.
Yeah, well, I've heard different definitions of doctrine coming out of the BYU religion faculty, and I'm not going to claim I have a better, superior.
Well, this is just speculative theology anyway.
That's right. But I'm influenced by the Catholic model because they've been doing this a long time. And I think they have some demarcations that are really, really useful. As I understand the Catholic tradition, a teaching is what you're likely to hear on any given Sunday. And teachings aren't always consistent. It's what somebody from the pulpit mm-hmm. is propounding. Doctrine is what is officially taught by, in their case, the magisterium. So it has to receive an official imprimatur. we don't have a corresponding magisterium. What we do have is a quorum and a first presidency. So I take, just personally, I take to be doctrinal that which has been taught by common consent of the quorum mm-hmm. and the first presidency as a whole. Mm-hmm. And this was the lesson that Gene England said he missed, yeah. right, yeah. to his pain until the very end of his life. He said, I realized that to follow the brother is not the same as following the brethren. Yeah. We're covenant bound to do the latter, but not the first. And so dogma, if we wanted to make a further distinction for a Catholic, a dogma is that which you have to believe, without which believing you cannot be orthodox. And so in the Latter-day Saint tradition, we have teachings, we have doctrines, but one doesn't have to accept all of them, for example, to go to the temple. So there isn't a temple recommend question that says, do you believe there were Nephites in ancient America? Now, I would say that's pretty much doctrine because it's taught universally by the leadership of the church, not a temple recommend question. So it doesn't seem to be something we have to believe in order to be considered Latter-day Saint in good standing. So I think that can be a useful distinction.
Yeah, I think
what do you have to believe to be considered? And what is just taught?
Yeah.
General.
Well, and it makes me wonder also, like, what do you have to lose? If this is a, I mean, I feel like someone could hear this and say, okay, this is semantics because we're qualifying and qualifying and qualifying till we whittle it down to something that someone can't knock down. You know, that this one thing doesn't change, but then you find out something that you would have called doctrine changes, and so you want to re-qualify it. And so just if it's semantics, like, what do we have to lose by entertaining the idea that maybe it does change? Like, is there something to be lost as a community if we think that maybe people like Eugene England actually do have influence and doctrine is evolving, and maybe the consensus does change over decades and centuries?
Yeah, I think the conflict comes when you say that and have one understanding of doctrine and I'm hearing you to say something else, right? In other words, yeah. Eternal truth doesn't change, I think is
yes.
what a leader would say.
Yeah.
And if you equate doctrine with eternal truth, then it doesn't change.
Okay.
Or if you yes. reduce doctrine, as some leaders have, said, look, the only time the word doctrine is used in the scriptures is to talk about the doctrine of Christ. And the doctrine of Christ doesn't change. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would okay. agree with those assertions. Yeah. But it's clearly, demonstrably the case that our understanding of various principles have changed and evolved. When Brigham Young used the word the light of Christ, he didn't mean it in the same way that we mean it today, for example. The way in which priesthood offices are organized has changed over time. There are all kinds of understandings of eternal principles that have yeah. clearly evolved and changed. So I just don't find it helpful to kind of erect mm-hmm. those categories mm-hmm. and try to rigidly enforce them in those ways. Yeah. I think all it does is make some people feel like apostates or
yeah, it yeah. makes it a weapon
outside the community, and it yeah. becomes weaponized.
Yeah. It seems like that additional adjective, true and living church, is maybe helpful here, right? Like the sort of core attribute of something that is living is that it is evolving.
Well,
and
I think this is
growing.
One of the great messages of President Nelson, right? Is that he's the first prophet who has emphasized, right, mm-hmm. the restoration as a process. The restoration mm-hmm. is unfolding. So it's clearly living yeah. in that sense. Yeah. Understanding is increasing.
Yeah.
And that means that there's a lot of tension though. And I think this book is this snapshot in time when there's so much tension. And he very generously says that he understands that he was part of this growing pain, the growing pains in the church, because he was yeah. right in the middle of it. But I wonder, like, after you did all of this research and then, you know, to Tim and to me while we were reading, it felt so familiar. It felt like so much of the correspondences could have happened today, even though it feels like such a different time. So I just wonder, as a scholar yourself, what have you seen change? Or does it feel like does it feel so much the same?
I think the whole history of the church is... culturally, it's like a pendulum, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of keep going back and forth between extremes. And mm-hmm. And I don't think there's a straight line trajectory in terms of how we as a church have learned to accommodate free and open conversation about contentious points.
Yeah.
I think in many ways, this is like, the last 10 years have been like a rerun of the 1970s for Gene England. I mean, what were the really? Primary issues he was concerned with? He was concerned with racism. Mm-hmm. He was concerned with the rights and place of LGBT.
Mm-hmm. And women.
And women.
Yeah.
Those three things. And we're still there, right? Mm-hmm. There is still a lot of boundary maintenance that one can say some things, but other things aren't welcome. I think, you know, we're a young church still. Sometimes I envy the Catholic Church. There's a great essay that was written by a theologian by the name of Marshall, and it was called The Theologian's Vocation. And he had this beautiful conception of the relationship between church dogma and theology. And he said, the theologian has a principal loyalty to truth. And if you're Catholic, you believe that's embodied in the church. And the job of the theologian has to always be subordinate or deferential toward truth as instituted in the church. And it seems to me that the Catholic Church long ago came to an understanding that each has its place and that they are mutually beneficial, the role of the leadership and the role of the theologian. They've been around 2,000 years, so they've learned to make that accommodation. And, I think we're still in a process of recognizing those mutual advantages. For example, right, in 2016, Elder Ballard yes. gave this right incredible talk that I think was a paradigm-shifting talk, although it hasn't received much notice in the last 6 or 7 years. But in this talk to CES educators, right, he said, quote, "We have failed to prepare our students adequately for the challenges of this world. A testimony is not an answer to a question."
Yeah.
If you have questions about history that your seminary teacher can't answer, right? Seminary teacher needs to go to the historians who can. So it was a beautiful recognition that, look, there is a symbiotic relationship, right? That Joseph Smith and the Doctrine and Covenants teach, right? Between knowledge in the heart, knowledge of the mind, between faith and scholarship. And Neil A. Maxwell, right, taught prominently this principle that scholarship is a form of worship. And yet today we often see these in relationship of tension, symbiosis.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, what's interesting maybe is that at that level between sort of academics and church authorities, there is that tension between scholarship and authority. But also at the lay level, there is tension between conscience and authority. And it's sort of the same thing, but yeah. just on a slightly different battlefront.
Yeah, I can talk about that. If I bore you, we can cut this out.
No, this was the part of the book where I felt like I felt the most emotional response because he was articulating something that feels so familiar, and it's like the ultimate pain. It's like the ultimate thing the ultimate conflict in the church. Is it either or? Is it conscience or authority? And sometimes it really does feel like either or. And so then what do you do? Like, how do you be all in and have integrity? Like, how do you face God and face a leader if it doesn't feel like they're one and the same suddenly?
Yeah. Well, in my understanding of restoration reading of the Garden of Eden, that was the primal conflict, right? Is there seems to be this authoritative dictum, but there also seems to be this clear, right, appeal to honor the good, the true, and the beautiful, and how do we reconcile that tension? And so I think for many people, not everyone, but for many, that's kind of the fundamental challenge of discipleship. And I think one reason why it can be particularly painful for Latter-day Saints is because we do not have a theology of conscience. The Catholic Church does. The Protestant Church does. We don't. Mm-hmm. And so here's why it's particularly difficult for us. The Catholic theology of conscience is really remarkable for its embrace of a paradox. If you're a Catholic in good standing, you believe that God speaks through the church and the church through time is infallible. So if you are in conflict with the church or church teachings, your responsibility is always to your conscience. The Catholic says that's your primary obligation. But if your conscience is at odds with the church, just know that your conscience is probably wrong. Mm-hmm. So I just think it's this beautiful kind of what it's saying is follow your conscience and be prepared to pay the price.
Yeah.
And so if the church sanctions you or disciplines you, take it because your conscience, faithfulness to conscience is worth any penalty, but be ready to pay the penalty. Protestant conception of conscience is very different, right? For Protestant, conscience is paramount. And there is no infallible church.
Right.
So you just follow your conscience.
Yeah.
And you may suffer at the secular arm, right? But you won't suffer from the church. So Gene England finds himself in this paradoxical situation. Everything about Latter-day Saint culture is individualistic. Everything is about agency.
Yeah.
And so he feels this call to conscience, but he can't react in the typical Protestant way because he's in a Catholic hierarchical universe. And so how do you resolve that?
Yeah, but you're saying even within Catholicism, the call is to follow your conscience, let the consequences come.
That's right.
I feel like our cultural understanding, at least the one I grew up with, was you may find your conscience and authority at odds with each other, but what you should do is fall in. So similar to Catholicism, authority is going to be right, but instead of following your conscience, you should follow the authority because eventually you're going to come around and your conscience will be proven to have been wrong in that first place. And so for us, it feels like, yes, it's agency, but what you're going to choose to do, wink, wink, is follow authority.
My understanding That's was cool. like you, everyone has access to personal revelation, but your personal revelation will never bring you into disagreement with the church.
And if it does,
and
your
so
personal
if it
revelation
does,
was wrong.
Then you were misguided. It wasn't personal revelation. It was
right.
your-
Well, that's certainly what Brigham Young explicitly taught, right? He's the only church leader I can find who talked sermonized about conscience, and he had a very Catholic
he
understanding
said,
of conscience.
Church.
He said you have to allow your conscience to be shaped by the church. Now, a lot of people are going to be uncomfortable with that, right? Yeah. But he said, look, conscience is generally a cultural formation, right? It depends on who your parents were, the culture in which you were raised, your peer group. All of those environmental influences will shape your conception of values.
Yes.
But we have a prophet who receives light and knowledge pure from God. And sometimes that's going to be in conflict with your cultural values, which you are interpreting as conscience. So allow yourself to be taught and shaped and formed by the revelation that comes through priesthood power.
100%. So I feel like my own conscience, just as sort of a case in point, was formed in large part by Mormonism.
Right.
Right. So and that's what can cause so much cognitive dissonance at times, especially when you sort of as it did with me, there's a lack of education that corresponds. So like, you know, I was learning things like integrity and honesty and faithfulness to a partner. And then I hear for the first time, you know, when I'm 21 or whatever, about Joseph Smith's polygamy and, you know, potential deception that went along with this. And it looks, you know, potential like a lot like unfaithfulness. And so it's like my Mormonism is now battling against my Mormonism and it's like tearing me apart. And that's why I think in part it's so difficult.
Yeah.
But I agree. There's no escaping. These formations that we have.
The extension of that is current social issues that feel actively problematic. You know, my compassion that the church helped me form is what is in absolute agony over LGBTQ issues. Like it is a gift from the church that is also causing, like that is the red flag, you know, that it feels like the spirit to me. And so what's the other side? So that's what Brigham Young was teaching. What's another way to,
well,
hey, to
here's,
frame
here's
this?
Here's another way I think to frame it is to think like to imagine yourself that you're in Utah in 1855 and Brigham Young comes to you and says, Tim, you got to practice polygamy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now there you're being asked to perform an action, to engage in conduct that you may or may not find in conflict with your conscience. Seems to me that that's not the situation today. We're not being asked to go out and expel gay people from our congregations. We're not being asked, right, to exercise prejudice. We're being asked to countenance a position the church has, which still allows us individually to practice that inclusiveness and that love and that acceptance that our conscience calls us to perform.
Maybe that's that could be the reason, I guess, why 2008 was difficult for so many people, because that was like a rare exception where there was actually a call to some sort of action.
That's right.
On Prop 8.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I do appreciate that, you know, the more we learn about faith stages, the more it seems like that kind of paradox, that kind of conflict is the most productive, you know, era of growth in every life. When it's a moral, it's a true moral dilemma, that's really the most stretching experience you can have as a human. And so I appreciate that. And I want the simplicity of being able to trust something, you know, universally.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I, you know, we have that statement from Joseph Smith that if we want to inherit the same kind of celestial glory as Abraham, we will be tried till our very heartstrings will break. Now, I think we all will have to face that kind of a trial, but it comes in very, very different ways. It may come through illness or suffering of a loved one. It may come through intellectual dissonance. But it seems to me that that's one of the kinds of sacrifices that discipleship requires.
Just not having the the validation of
not having the golden idol of certainty.
The golden idol of certainty. Yeah.
I think that's what we crave. And I've written before on the fact that I think the Brothers Karamazov is the best engagement with that human yearning we have. We want to have an infallible source that we can just turn to. And it seems to me that the church teachings are consistent from the beginning in saying you can't go that way.
Yeah.
You always are going to have to rely upon a personal confirmatory experience of the Spirit.
Yeah. Do you think that because this was pre-internet, do you think that there was more attention and pressure and consequently also that his positions were magnified because there were so few channels to put information out? I just feel like if he had a blog, you know, a couple years ago, I think like, would he have really gotten the attention and all the scrutiny and, you know, all of these conversations with leaders? It just feels like there's too much.
Okay,
now,
I think that's a really good point, right? The marketplace of ideas is much more crowded today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The democratization.
There aren't like two places to publish.
There aren't two. They're infinite and too many. Too many people have voices that they shouldn't have in the public sphere.
Should we get a soapbox out for you to stand on, Tara?
But there are other reasons. So that's one reason, right? And he had unique access. He was editor of Dialogue Magazine. He taught at BYU. He published. And so he had a soapbox that gave him that opportunity. But the other thing that made his voice distinctive is that, Christine Hagelin wrote a lovely study of Jean England that she called the Mormon liberal, right? And there's no disputing that. His whole life he was trying to deconstruct those categories of conservative and liberal, orthodox and heterodox. But there's no doubting the fact that he was virtually unique in the LDS intellectual world, certainly within institutional structures, in being at the left end of the political spectrum. And so that gained him a prominence he wouldn't have today, because there are more of those, I think.
I want to do justice to the fact that this is not, I mean, it wasn't just, you know, these principles that you debated in the book. This is actually a biography of sterling quality as well. I wonder if you could maybe, just since we haven't really done this yet, give us some of the formative experiences that England had, and just maybe a general outline of sort of the arc that his life took. We've referenced, you know, these conflicts that he's had, but listeners may not actually be familiar with how this all came about.
Yeah. The one quality that emerges in starkest relief at the end of his life was that he embodied a tension between the most, you know, today we'd call it progressive, intellectually adventuresome, unbridled, thought, with an absolute commitment to a charismatic Mormonism. In other words, he believed in the gifts of the Spirit. He experienced the gifts of the Spirit. And so I think one of the most formative influences that he would often hark back to was hearing his father pray and bless a planting on their farm. And what he perceived through the lens of his father to be the perceptible reality of Christ. And so his engagement with Mormonism was never primarily through an intellectual lens. It was always in an affective relationship. And he recounted experiences as a bishop, where he had miraculous interventions and expressions of the Spirit. At the same time, he's out there in a Western, California school during the 1960s. Mm-hmm. And so he's in the middle, of all, the Berkeley Revolution and the free speech and anti-Vietnam War. And so that could only end in violent collision between those two things. And that's why the name of the journal that he co-founded, Dialogue, is really the single most apt description of the value that he committed his life to defending. He was naive in many ways. He was an optimist. He was really, really convinced that good people coming together in frank and open, trusting conversation can build bridges. And in that hope, he was disappointed again and again and again because of the fury and fire that his work so often elicited.
Yeah. It was an interesting part of, I mean, it wasn't just a part of the book. Throughout the book, he would be in contact with members of the Quorum of the Twelve or other general authorities. And he would, you know, he would send them his writing. He'd hope for, and he just continually, he hoped, it seemed, in the writing that he was doing to these authorities to have their approval.
He wanted approval and he wanted affirmation.
Yes.
All of us do, but most of us mask it better than he
does. Yes. And it seems so, yes, so forward. And he was so disappointed, so devastated when he didn't get it. Although I have heard pushback on this one point about this book that, and I don't even remember where I heard this, but potentially there's one interpretation in which he's naive and continually sort of like places himself on the railroad tracks.
Yeah.
And another interpretation where he knew exactly what he was doing. You come down sort of on the side of naivete.
I come down on the side of naivete, but also self-knowledge. I mean, there's this really remarkable passage in one of his autobiographical book, right, where he imagines an ancestor describing him. And I just reread it today to make sure I was remembering it correctly, but he appraises himself through this fictional character as often lying, as evading the truth, as masking his own deficiencies and ignorance. So he's very self-aware that at times he is not acting on the noblest of motives. But I think I don't think you can get away from the fact that at some level he was just naive mm-hmm. in trusting too much to the goodness in human nature. I also think, and this colors my overall appraisal of him, I couldn't convey this effectively in the biography. But the most moving experience for me in the course of the 3 or 4 years I worked on this was Charlotte, his widow, gave me 2 very, very large binders that were filled with literally hundreds of notes and letters that had been written. And to have this experience of leafing through testimony after testimony after testimony of people whose lives were changed or who were brought to Christ through his personal and personalized ministry made me think that he was in that regard one of the holiest men in the modern church. I don't know anyone or know of anybody who more effectively expressed Christ-like love at an individual level. And, you know, that kind of thing didn't feature prominently in his public persona, in his writings, or it was like this personal ministry that he was always engaged in that left me profoundly moved.
Yeah. I think this real sense of experiential faith seems like the kite string. Like it kept him tethered, and then he was able to just, you know, explore anything and feel very safe wondering about truth. And I think, you know, however uncomfortable leadership or his peers or his students were with the way he embraced that paradox, he seemed to fully embody that. He felt completely safe and completely free.
Yeah. I love that metaphor. You know, one of the common motifs in the call to be a prophet, right, is resistance, right? Isaiah doesn't want it, and Moses doesn't want it, Enoch doesn't want it. It's beautifully depicted in C.S. Lewis's novel Perelandra, where the main character Jack feels himself, he's afraid. They're all afraid of the same thing. What is Jonah fleeing? It's the fear of being sucked in to this commitment that you know you'll never be able to escape. And I think in some ways that's Gene England. His life would have been a whole lot easier if at some point he could have just said, nah, it's not worth it. I'm leaving for more liberal cultures and environments. But he couldn't. He was tethered in that way. You know, I admire a lot of things about Gene England, and I've drawn very close to him in profound ways through the experience and the aftermath of writing this book. But one of the things I love most about him is that he believed discipleship was inseparable from risk. And that's wow. Not a way that we often phrase it or characterize discipleship. But, you know, I believe this very, very deeply, that our love is always proportioned and proportional to the risk that it entails, right? I mean, the marriage commitment itself is the single most risky thing you'll ever engage in all of eternity, right? To tie your identity to another human being and not know what that human being is going to be doing 50 years from now, it's a terrifying prospect. But your unwillingness to be able to do that would be a measure of the inadequacy of your love. And so I think that that's absolutely true of the divine as well, right? In the absence of certainty, we are risking everything. We are saying, I'm going to live my whole life as if you exist. And if I'm wrong, I've given my life for a bet that didn't pan out. But my love for you is sufficient to generate the energy with which I will live that commitment.
Yeah.
And he understood that. And for him, risk was a much broader enterprise. You have to risk in speaking truth to power. One of his most magnificent essays that was remarkably published in the Ensign, Speaking Truth to Power. He put himself on the line. He was out in the marches and at the protests and you know, being a lightning rod. And at times he realized he'd pushed the boundaries too far and he would repent. Most famously in the episode where he called out the Committee on Strengthening Members, not knowing that it was staffed by two apostles. Right. But, you know, it's like Pahoran and Moroni in the Book of Mormon. Favorite part of the Book of Mormon is where one can recognize that your impulses were so noble, even though the expression was inept. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true of him time and time again. Yeah.
Would you want to read, just to give listeners a sense for both a little bit of your prose and England's, a section about that essay that appeared in the Ensign?
Yeah. 2 years later, on the cusp of his successful reapplication to BYU, England succeeded in placing an article with a kindred tone in the church's own monthly magazine, The Ensign. The article was a coup of sorts. It was as subversive a piece as The Ensign was ever likely to publish, bringing England's message to the Orthodox masses. And that venue gave a kind of official imprimatur to his plea. The essay is a blatant appeal for a cultural shift in the direction of more frank dialogue and less fear of offending the guardians of orthodoxy. Quote, we need to cultivate moral courage. It seems clear that most forms of insincere and unloving speech arise from fear. Fear of serious reflection on what we most care about and want to be. Fear of exposing our limited selves. Fear of the opinion or power of others. One can also read the article as a personal apologia for England's own provocative writings and speaking. Quote, if we will only begin to take some risks, speaking the truth lovingly and boldly, even though we feel inept or weak or exposed, the Lord will keep his promises and we will be surprised at the response in others and in ourselves. If we can develop the courage to take some personal risks and can learn to rely on the Spirit as we break out of old inhibitions and prejudices, we can be more effective in both vigorously defending the faith in the world and in lovingly challenging people in the church to live the gospel better.
That's incredible. First of all, I can't believe that appeared in the Ensign.
I know.
How did that happen, do you think?
Don't know any of the details, but I'm guessing Levina Anderson may have been the editor at that time.
Okay.
And she appreciated and admired his writings, yeah. And I think was willing to push the envelope occasionally.
Yeah. It also, it's making me sort of envision a church full of Eugene Englands and what that might look like. And I get...
Look like, a little like heaven.
Okay, that's where I was going, but it certainly makes me excited. But it raises this question too of, I mean, and this is more, even a more broad societal question, but where are the lines of free speech? I think my perception is, I'll admit, culturally, we're way too averse to saying what we think. We're too full of fear, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah.
But certainly there is, I think there is a very valid argument that I also agree with to be made that it can't just be an absolute free for all. Where do you think Eugene England, or where would you draw a line in terms of what we say at church, or what we express in private, or what we write on our blogs, those kinds of things?
Yeah. You know, recently I read a book called The Practice of the Presence of God. And it's by a monk named Brother Lawrence, who lived in the 17th century. And he seems to have been what today we would call a simpleton, impaired maybe in some ways. He was a soldier in the 30 Years' War. He was wounded. He became a servant. He was too clumsy and stupid to thrive as a servant. And so he went to a monastery, thinking he could live a life devoted to God. But he was illiterate and unchurched, so they just made him a cook in the kitchen. So he spends the rest of his life as a cook in the kitchen. But the most remarkable thing about him, people would comment, people who went to visit him or wrote about him, was that he was so in love with God that at times he would just break out into these kind of dances. At times he would just start talking to God in the midst of whoever was around him. At times he felt God just wanted to know he loved him, so he would turn to where he imagined God to be and tell him how much he loved him. A simpleton, right? Today, another way we might describe that is to say that he was lacking in social intelligence. So this really led me to think about how, in cultivating and curating our identities on social media, right, we become obsessed with what our effect is going to be in terms of how it reflects back on us.
Yeah.
And I think that that kind of cuts to the heart of what Jean England was trying to tell us about risk and about authenticity. We have to be socially astute enough to know if our words are going to be interpreted in ways that are volatile or divisive or subversive. So I think that's one boundary pushing back against us. But at the same time, I think we have to be willing to risk in expressing authentically what we take to be the truths that we know and feel are true. Having said that, it's also the fact that we do not inhabit a democracy. And I think that's what's so frustrating.
In the church.
That we we want to import democratic principles and values into our life in the church. And so I think we have to recognize that there are very limited ways in which we can make our influence felt. And just two things that I've tried to find consolation in. One is that all politics is local. So is all religion. There's virtually no limit to the influence you can have in your ward just by the way you treat people. And second is that there have been effective ways that thoughtful people have made their influence felt in the church. And I think Lester Bush is a prime example of this, right?
Yeah.
And his path was scholarship. He said, I'm not going to argue about whether the priesthood ban is right. I'm going to excavate it and find out what's there. And it changed the church. So I think if our motives are pure, then we have to find those routes to influence that don't make an idol of our own integrity, right?
Yeah.
And I think I might have used that expression with Jean England, that sometimes that was one of his faults. You know, it's kind of like the person who says, yeah, there's a Jew hiding behind my door. I'm not going to lie. And then,
right,
drag the Jew to Auschwitz. There's some things at times that are more important than our own, right, integrity,
yeah,
if we are putting it up as an idol. And so I think that's the other thing that we have to remember in all social media interactions is, are we genuinely trying to forward the interests of the body of Christ?
Mm. I really love that because, you know, most of us are not a Lester Bush or an England, but I totally believe that there are avenues that are as unique as our own gifts and that's our way to influence things for good.
There are two things that prompts in my own mind. One is, you know, Harold B. Lee and at least two other apostles from his era I can find in print who said the church is a scaffold. And if we think about the church as a scaffold, well, then what's the building? Oh, the building is, the body of Christ. And keep that perspective. I think that allows us to have a much healthier relationship to the church. And the second thing, one of my favorite moments in Marilyn Robinson's Gilead. So when she's talking about revelation and vision, and she says, we often don't get the revelation except in retrospect, looking back. And then we go, that was a vision. That was a revelation. And I think that is true of our lives. our lives can't be understood in the present. Mm-hmm. They can only be understood when the story is over, or at least this phase of it. And then we can put it into a context and make sense of what our life meant and represented. I look at all the great heroes of the past, whether it's a Thomas More or Orson Pratt or my own hero after writing this book, Marion D. Hanks, right? Mm-hmm. One never understood exactly at the moment what the stakes were and what the historical repercussions would be, but we know now.
Yeah.
Yeah. It seems more and more to me that the whole project of whatever is going on with this life is, you know, it's about growth. And growth comes from struggle, and struggle comes from not knowing what's going on in the moment, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's really just the seed of this amazing, and that's what I love most about it. That's my number one favorite thing about Mormon theology, is that we've got so much growth ahead of us that it's impossible to comprehend, and it has to start somewhere. And a lot of times that's uncertainty and difficulty.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The first four Christian centuries were characterized by what theologians refer to as the theology of ascent. And so there was this very deeply entrenched idea that, in fact, Origen translates, "In my father's house are many mansions." He translates that, "In my father's house are many stages." Mm. Isn't that great?
That is great.
I love that.
So it was common. I think it was the most common reading of what happened in the Garden of Eden, that was collateral damage, not a catastrophe. No, the project is still unfolding. No, this is what's supposed to happen. And we're on this road to eternal ascent. Mm-hmm. We call that theosis or divinization, but it was there in the early church. And it was such a more beautiful way of thinking about life than, beginning with catastrophe.
Yeah. You mentioned this. I know we need to start wrapping up, but you mentioned this idea that anything to an absolute becomes an idol. And so it makes sense that, you know, if our life is about growth and tension and uncertainty, then having anything that we feel especially certain and absolute about can really does sort of play in our life like an idol. But can you talk about how, you know, I'm thinking about prophets and the prophet's place again, and how would you articulate the place of a prophet in a, you know, that can be in our life in a healthy way and not play this role of an idol for us? It feels like it's easy to swing too far one way or another.
Yeah, well, I think there are many different relationships that one can feel one has to prophetic leadership. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's a right way. I mean, we're required to sustain our leaders, although that word doesn't appear in scripture except in reference to the Constitution. But as I understand Joseph's primary self-understanding, right? If one correlates, and I did this in one of my studies where I looked to see when was he making his revisions to the Joseph Smith translation of the Bible?
Yeah.
And when are the revelations recorded in the Doctrine and Covenants occurring? And one can see this pervasive interconnection. But it's when he retranslates Matthew 16 that this creates this surge of revelation. And you can go back to the date and see that from that day on, he hardly gets a revelation where the word keys doesn't appear.
Mm. Really?
So when he sees, oh, this was what happened. Christ was giving to Peter keys. It wasn't about charismatic gifts or special power. It was about keys. And so I think that's why in Joseph Smith's thinking, temple theology becomes paramount. And temple theology is about keys, that God commits to the prophet this authority that encompasses the totality of the new and everlasting covenant, that is manifest through covenantal obligations that we make, sacramental things that we perform in the temple, that are more than just symbolic, but of eternal efficacy. And so I recognize the prophet as having those keys, and I think the temple recommend interview, right? He's the only one. That's what the temple recommend asks.
Yeah.
Do you believe he has all the keys?
Yeah.
And so I'm very content with that focus, that all of our temple theology and power and authority vested in that man. He also speaks and as inspired by the Holy Ghost to give general counsel to us, to members, to the world. The keys is the primary function that Joseph Smith understood.
That's super interesting. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Terrell. If I can pay you a compliment, I feel like at least for us, you know, coming up in sort of in this millennial generation, in many ways, you and Fiona have taken on the mantle of Eugene England and sort of embodied this this moral courage right alongside faithfulness.
It's a beautiful thing to say. Thank you, Tim.
Of course. I mean it very sincerely. And thank you for doing this interview with us. Maybe I should tease to a part two that we're planning. England had a unique theology of atonement, and we thought that would be a good jumping off point for another conversation to come in the near future.
Love to come back and talk about that.
Thanks, Daryl.
Thank you. All right, thanks so much for listening. We really hope that you enjoyed this conversation with Terrell Gibbons. If you'd like to read or listen to Stretching the Heavens, The Life of Eugene England and the Crisis of Modern Mormonism, again, you can check it out on Amazon or Audible. And as always, if Faith Matters content is resonating with you and you get the chance, we would love for you to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you listen on. We read all of the reviews, and it really does help us to get the word out about Faith Matters, and we appreciate the support. Thanks again for listening, and remember, you can check out more at faithmatters.org.